Has anything been done to protect future elections?
No.
Well, there's a straight answer from an FBI guy who ought to know. The answer is no.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on Queso, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans's WHIV, in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, in Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk. You can run, but you can't hide from the Bradcast as much as I'd like to, perhaps every day. As we blanket the earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. I want to get right to the breaking news, because it's encouraging news. Everything else may go downhill thereafter. We'll see, including Desi Doyen and the Green News Report, which comes up a little bit later.
Uplifting. We're looking for uplifting.
Uplifting. Well, let's start with this uplifting news here, just breaking now from a federal court. A second federal judge on Tuesday has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from ending the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Judge Nicholas Garofas of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York ruled that the DACA participants and states are likely to succeed in their challenge to the way that President Donald Trump terminated the Obama-era DACA program, finding that it was done arbitrarily and capriciously when Trump just reversed the Obama program. Trump had last year announced his plan to end DACA, the policy that allowed undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to stay in the country. That would end effective March 5, and that deadline has now become central in the congressional debate over immigration, but Democrats and Republicans are nowhere near a breakthrough, according to CNN. Frankly, unless a clean DACA bill by itself is brought up for a vote, that would likely pass in both houses, both the House and the Senate. But without that, I don't know that we will ever see such a breakthrough, because, frankly, Republicans and Donald Trump are simply blocking a breakthrough because they don't like immigrants, period. At least not ones from, you know, other countries other than Norway, where the immigrants are pale. Tuesday's ruling, combined with another ruling from a California judge last month, means that the DACA program could end up going beyond the March 5 date at this point. Now, with these two different courts finding pretty much the same thing, Garofas wrote that defendants indisputably can end the DACA program. He's talking about the Trump administration there. The question before the court is thus not whether defendants could end the DACA program, but whether they offered legally adequate reasons for doing so. The judge said, based on its review of the record before it, the court concludes that defendants have not done so. He said that the decision to end the program was based in part on the, quote, plainly incorrect factual premise, unquote, that the program itself was illegal. So he can Donald Trump can end DACA if he wants, but he has to come up with a justification for doing it other than pronouncing that it was illegal when there has been no court finding that, in fact, it is illegal. So maybe some good news if you're a dreamer or one of their families. 800,000 could be deported as early as March 5th when this deadline hits. But some encouraging news for those kids who have been here for decades. Many of them, now have kids of their own who are U.S. citizens. They're going to school. They're working across the country. About 800 of them are in the U.S. No, about 800 of them are in the U.S. Armed Forces.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
So we're going to start deporting people from the U.S. Armed Forces, apparently, as of March 5th. But this judge's ruling should at least stay that for a little bit longer. Yes.
Well, when we spoke with Jess Hansen of the National Immigration Law Center last week, she recommended that anybody who's in the DACA program, or if you know someone in the DACA program, to go to their website at nilc.org in order to get tips and recommendations for how to continue your applications, because this is a crucial period for people and they need to make sure all their T's are crossed and their I's are dotted properly.
Yep. Yeah, and she encourages those people who did have DACA coverage before to go ahead and re-up right away, but stop by NILC.org for tips on how to get some help on that from attorneys and stuff, because they are beginning to make it difficult. All right, we have seen a virtual flood of high-ranking intelligence community officials like former acting CIA director John McLaughlin late last week calling for paper ballots for every voter in the wake of what the U.S. intelligence community alleges were attempts by Russia or agents affiliated with them to try and access our computerized election systems during the 2016 elections. The intelligence community insists that while attempts were made to access voter registration databases in 21 states, only a small number of those attempts were successful, though they will not identify which states, and several of them, including California and Wisconsin, have charged that the Department of Homeland Security was wrong in their assessments. Nonetheless, at the same time, the intelligence officials continue to claim that they have no evidence that actual voting and tabulation systems were manipulated by Russians or anybody else. They haven't said they weren't manipulated. They say they have no evidence. And they frankly admitted as much last summer. Some of those same federal officials, neither they nor anybody else actually checked the voting and tabulation computers in question to see if they were manipulated. Neither did they bother to count paper ballots where they do exist to make sure that they matched the computer reported election results following the 2016 presidential election. So I take it both with a grain of salt, when they suggest that there is that there was no tampering of those results. The fact is, we simply don't know. I also take it with a grain of salt when they call for a paper ballot, that's the way to protect our votes. Well, yes, it is, as long as it's a hand-marked paper ballot. But in states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the attempt by Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein to seek a hand count of the paper ballots after the stunning results of the 2016 presidential election, her effort was blocked in all three states by state laws and by the GOP, which went to court to prevent her and, frankly, voters across the land from ensuring that paper ballots, where they existed, were actually tabulated as per voters' intent. What good does a paper ballot do if you're not allowed to count it? Still, many intelligence officials are calling for paper ballots immediately. That's a good thing, I suppose, as are a number of politicians and pundits finally realizing the need for paper ballots. One of those pundits includes Peggy Noonan, a Republican pundit. She's the former Ronald Reagan speechwriter. She was on Meet the Press on Sunday and talked about just that.
We are, as we all know, a deeply divided country. One thing that could damage this nation terribly is having a national election where the outcome is unclear because we got hacked. Right away, we should start saying, you got to go paper ballots. We'll figure out all this internet magic technological stuff, but for now, paper ballots in America, so Ohio knows how it voted.
Okay, so Ohio knows how it voted. What about Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania? Should they know? Should they have already known how they voted after the 2016 presidential election? Where were the Peggy Noonans lining up to demand paper ballots, which already exist across most of Wisconsin and Michigan? Where were they lining up to demand those ballots were actually counted back then in the most stunning political upset in American history? And one that happened to be razor thin, a razor thin margin, despite what Donald Trump says. In fact, had just three votes been recorded for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump in each precinct in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, she would have won the presidency. So I can't think of a better time to have gone back to check those paper ballots, to have human beings actually count them. Where was Peggy Noonan then? Where were these Republicans and these intelligence officials who are now saying we need a paper ballot? Why weren't they demanding that we counted the paper ballots? And for that matter, why didn't the intelligence community itself try to count those paper ballots, investigate those electronic voting and tabulation systems to make sure that they had not been hacked? Since they keep warning us that this is what Russians were doing, at least when it came to the voter registration systems, and they still haven't presented any evidence of that either. But apparently just having paper ballots is enough for some, even if we have seen over and over again that it's almost impossible for the public to go back and actually count those paper ballots when we need to count those paper ballots. Whatever the computers say are the results after the election, on election night in general, that will remain the results, no matter what, in most states. Here's former FBI agent Clint Watts. He was asked about this as well on Meet the Press this past Sunday.
Has anything been done to protect future elections?
No. They've worked on the critical infrastructure designation, but the number one thing we got to do is ensure the integrity of the vote. Right now, we still can't ensure that the vote is accurate or not changed. We need paper ballot backups. We need to always be able to ensure that the vote is correct.
So has anything been done? No. We need paper ballot backups. We don't need paper ballot backups because backup procedures are not used, as we saw in Wisconsin, in Michigan, and Pennsylvania. We need paper ballots, yes, but they must be hand-marked paper ballots. Right now, many Democrats, in fact, are calling for computer-marked paper ballots. We're about to get those across the entire Los Angeles County out here, the largest voting jurisdiction in the nation. Those are as 100% impossible to verify as reflecting voters' intent after an election as touchscreen direct recording electronic systems are. Those DRE touchscreens made by Diebold and ESNS and Sequoia. And those hand-marked paper ballots that we need, if we really want to know who won or lost any given election, and I'm not, frankly, convinced that these people actually do want to know, those hand-marked paper ballots must be publicly hand-counted, preferably on election night at the precinct in front of all the parties and all the video cameras with results posted right then and there before those hand-marked and hand-counted paper ballots are moved anywhere. That's the ultimate goal for what I call democracy's gold standard when it comes to casting and counting ballots, so that we are all able to know, all parties, voters for the winners and for the losers alike, we all need to know that the election results actually reflect voter intent. I was drawn to a tweet today from Marcy Wheeler. We've had her on the show many times, national security journalist over there at Empty Wheel. She tipped me off to a comment made by Senator Mark Warner, Democrat, this morning, ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, during their public hearing on Tuesday with the heads of the FBI, the CIA, the DHS, and others. She said that Senator Warner compared hand-counting ballots to ensure elections to the cost of one single F-35. The F-35 stealth fighter jet is what he was talking about. It's one of our most advanced weapon systems. We currently have more than 265 of them. No problem finding money for those, apparently. With more in production for reasons that remain both controversial and unclear. In any event, after this comment, Desi, I had you run over to C-SPAN to see if you could find those comments from Tuesday's Senate hearings.
Yep.
And, well, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia did say something like that, sort of, during his closing comments of this hearing today.
One of the things that has struck me is that if you do a rough calculation and add up the costs to Russia in terms of their intervention in America, elections, the Dutch elections where they hand-counted all the ballots, the French elections where Facebook acknowledged taking down 30,000 sites, you add that all together, it's less than the cost of one new F-35 airplane. Pretty good bang for the buck.
Yeah, the cost of hand counting our ballots, he says, could be the cost of one single F-35. Andy Valeri on Twitter, he's the one who actually tipped me off to Marcy's tweet on this matter, added, which one, hand counting ballots or buying another F-35, will be more effectively important for ensuring the defense of our democracy? Good question, Andy, though I'm fairly sure that that question really answers itself. At least I hope it does for Bradcast listeners and readers of bradblog.com who have followed our coverage for the past 15 years in trying to sound the alarm on exactly this. But in some states, getting any kind of paper ballots is still a fight for many voters, whether they're counted or not. Many voters are still forced to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreens still after all of these years. We still have about 25% of our votes cast completely unverifiably on touchscreen voting systems in all or parts of states like Louisiana, South Carolina, Texas, Ohio, Wisconsin, Georgia, and yes, Pennsylvania. Across much of Pennsylvania, in fact, where voters were blocked from hand-counting paper ballots, where they exist, in some of the places where they exist in Pennsylvania after the 2016 election, and where Jill Stein's attempt to forensically examine those touchscreen voting systems to see if they were manipulated in any way, that attempt was rejected. But there may finally, at long last, be some hope, at least a bit, sort of, for Pennsylvania voters. Though not much, frankly, particularly before the 2018 elections. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf on Friday ordered counties that plan to replace their electronic voting systems to buy machines that leave a paper trail. But his budget does not include any money to fund the replacement of the state's aging and what AP describes as increasingly vulnerable fleet of voting machines. The Democrats' administration said the move to require the new systems include a paper backup will increase the security of voting systems and make balloting easier to audit. You mean make it so that it can be audited at all? Ever? Maybe? Yeah, okay, maybe. Acting Secretary of State in Pennsylvania said in a statement that this directive will ensure that the next generation of the Commonwealth's voting systems conform to enhanced standards of resiliency, auditability, and security. The Wolf administration said in a statement later on Friday that it's working on a comprehensive overhaul of the state's election apparatus, including its voter registration base. The state, however, is not requiring counties to discard their old equipment, at least for now. The directive only requires them to buy machines with a paper backup if they decide to switch systems. Nor does the Wolf administration's budget plan released this week include any new money to help counties replace their aging and wildly vulnerable systems. Now, the good thing about this is that the Pennsylvania Constitution does not currently allow for direct recording electronic touchscreen machines that include a so-called voter verifiable paper audit trail, a VVPAT, as we call it. That's that little toilet paper roll that voters can theoretically view before their vote is cast. But that paper is never actually counted by anyone. So the touchscreen systems in Pennsylvania have no paper whatsoever to tell the voters how anything is recorded, but those little papers are meaningless as it is. The computer internally records whatever it wants, no matter what those little pieces of paper say, and nobody bothers to count those pieces of paper. But for all of the supposed panic over Russian hacking, we sure don't seem to be in much of a rush in this country to install publicly overseeable systems which make such hacking and tampering, whether by Russians or Chinese or Iranians or Canadians or Mexicans or Americans, including election officials who have the most direct access to these systems. We're not in any hurry to make it any more difficult to carry out manipulation by anybody in any country, to make it harder for them to do that and to make it much easier to catch when and if it happens. No rush. Our friend and longtime Pennsylvania election integrity champion, Mary Beth Kuznick, the founder and executive director of Vote PA, she's quoted in the article saying that the General Assembly needs to step up to the plate and budget for this. She nonetheless sees this move as a huge step forward for Pennsylvania, she says, for better elections. She says it's just huge. I know she has been working on this as long as I have in Pennsylvania. So they're finally moving in the right direction, at least in Pennsylvania. So there's that. That's good. Virginia banned the use of touchscreen voting machines in last November's gubernatorial contest over concerns that the equipment could be hacked. They just got rid of them quickly. And maybe it's just a coincidence, but after years of dominance by Republicans in the state House of Delegates in Virginia, Democrats came within one vote, literally one vote, one paper vote, one hand-marked paper ballot that was hand-counted. They came within one of winning back control of that house after they moved from touchscreens to paper ballots. But of course, even if every voter who wishes to vote is allowed to vote, yes, voter suppression is another place where Republicans continue to game the system to their advantage. And even if every vote cast is counted and counted accurately in a way that voters can know it's been counted accurately, even if we get all of that, the GOP and a whole bunch of states have long gamed the process itself, the structure itself, through gerrymandering, particularly in states like Pennsylvania, where the GOP drew maps after the 2010 census to ensure that they would retain a 13-5 seat advantage in the U.S. House, even though it's essentially a 50-50 state, though with far more registered Democrats than Republicans. And yet, Republicans have a 13-5 advantage in the U.S. House, thanks to the way they drew the district lines. But on that front, we have some good news as well today. It's also a bit qualified, but it seems to be less qualified than the sort of kind of move to paper ballots that's going on in Pennsylvania. This news has the state Supreme Court muscle behind it. And that's next on the broadcast, as we're joined by David Daley, author of a book on GOP gerrymandering, whose title I can't even say on the air. Stay tuned for that. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your broadcast. Rain. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That is what Democrats are trying to keep from falling down on them in 2018. But hey, you know, speaking of Pennsylvania, you will recall last month that the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania found the state's U.S. House maps, as drawn by the Republicans who controlled the state legislature after the 2010 census, were in violation of the Pennsylvania state constitution, and the state Supreme Court ordered those maps to be redrawn immediately in time for Pennsylvania's 2018 U.S. House primary elections, which begin in May. State Republicans challenged the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, but they were rejected there, and on Friday they finally submitted a new map to the Democratic governor, as ordered by the state Supreme Court, which said that they would, the court itself would draw the maps if the legislature could not come up with one that was approved by the governor. Republican leaders of the Pennsylvania legislature on Friday produced a new proposed map of the state's congressional districts, 3 weeks after the state Supreme Court declared the former map unconstitutional, according to the AP. The proposal drafted by Republican House Speaker Mike Terzai and Republican Senate President pro tempore Joe Scarnati would make widespread changes, but would keep nearly 70% of residents in their old districts. The two Republicans forwarded the map and other materials to Democratic Governor Tom Wolf, who has until Thursday of this week to let the justices on the state Supreme Court know if he supports this new map or not. If not, the court has indicated that it will develop its own map. Some, if not many, of the finer points of the old map have drawn criticism. Some of those criticisms were addressed, says AP. Democratic leaders in the legislature promptly released a letter sent to Wolf urging him to reject the new Republican map because it was a product of two Republican leaders as opposed to a product of the General Assembly as a body, as it seems the state Supreme Court had called for. The Democrats argued that that had violated the court order's discussion of enactment of a remedial congressional district plan. The Senate Minority Leader Jay Costa and House Minority Leader Frank Dermati wrote in the letter that the Republican leadership in both chambers blocked the process, refused to negotiate, and have now submitted a map directly to your office, to the governor's office, that they had not even seen. Today, then, the governor announced his response to that map given to him on Friday by those two Republicans, even though that map was not approved by the state legislature. And again, from AP, they report that Democratic Governor Tom Wolf will not submit this new Republican-drawn map of Pennsylvania's congressional districts to the state's high court, saying on Tuesday that it uses the same unconstitutionally partisan tactics as the six-year-old boundaries that were struck down in the gerrymandering case. Wolf's move comes now just 6 days before the deadline set by the state Supreme Court to impose new boundaries for Pennsylvania's 18 congressional districts. Redrawing the map of Pennsylvania districts could boost Democrats nationally in their quest to take control of the U.S. House, but this battle in Pennsylvania leaves district boundaries up in the air in Pennsylvania barely 3 months before the May primary election. The governor said his office's analysis of the plan put forward on Friday by leaders of the Republican-controlled legislature concluded that it was clearly designed to help their own candidates. The governor's office had retained a mathematician with an expertise in redistricting to review this GOP-drawn map. In a one-page summary, that mathematician said on Tuesday, it was released by the governor's office, and the mathematician called the GOP's plan, revised plan, quote, extremely and unnecessarily partisan. Republicans who drew the proposal said that it adhered to the court's line-drawing benchmarks, eliminating dozens of municipal and county divisions and creating more compact districts. Nonetheless, it does keep nearly 70% of residents and apparently every incumbent congressman in their old districts. So with 3 weeks to go now before the deadline and just over a month before the primary elections actually happen in Pennsylvania, U.S. House candidates have no idea what district they may or may not be running in this year, and voters have no idea who they will or won't be able to vote for or against. This is all in addition to the mess with our easily manipulated computerized voting, registration, and tabulation systems that we use in this country. And it's part and parcel of the way the system has been, yes, rigged over the years in a way that almost always seems to end up helping Republicans. When it comes to the plan that they laid out before the 2010 election to take over state legislatures during a census year so that they could wildly gerrymander state legislative and U.S. House maps in the next decade, the program they ran at that time has been incredibly effective at ensuring GOP control of both state legislatures and the U.S. House, no matter how many Democrats seem to show up to vote, how many more Democrats show up than Republicans, as is the case in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Texas, and many others. The last time we had our friend David Daley on the program, who quite literally wrote the book on the well-funded and well-planned GOP scheme to redraw America's legislative maps, I believe he had just got out of the U.S. Supreme Court hearing on Gill v. Whitford, the landmark case challenging a federal court ruling last year that found the GOP-controlled legislature in the state of Wisconsin had employed unconstitutional gerrymandering for its state legislative districts in order to ensure Republican majorities in the state house as far as the eye could see. Republicans challenged that ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court after the lower court had ordered them to redraw all of those illegally drawn districts in Wisconsin. And shortly after that, another federal court panel ruled that the entire U.S. House maps in the state of North Carolina needed to be immediately redrawn as well for the same reasons. The Republican legislature there had used partisan gerrymandering of congressional seats to ensure the GOP retained a 10-3 advantage in the U.S. House there in the essentially 50-50 swing state. That ruling in North Carolina was, of course, like the Wisconsin ruling, placed on hold by the U.S. Supreme Court pending their decision in that Wisconsin case. So it is now unlikely that either of these maps in Wisconsin or North Carolina will be redrawn in time for the upcoming 2018 midterms. And then last month, that's when we finally got to Pennsylvania, where the state Supreme Court ordered those new U.S. House maps to be drawn up, after finding there that it was also an illegal gerrymander, but in violation of the state constitution as opposed to federal law. That allowed Republicans to ensure a 13-5 GOP advantage in the U.S. House over this past decade in what is a similarly 50-50 swing state, though Democrats there have a pretty substantial advantage over Republicans in voter registration. But because that ruling was a state court ruling, the GOP effort to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to delay the order to draw up new maps in time for the upcoming primaries was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court happily, and now the battle is on to come up with those new House maps in Pennsylvania in time for the primaries in the Keystone State. Here to discuss all of this and his new exclusive at Salon, based on hundreds of new GOP documents from before the 2010 redistricting scheme was put in place, is our old friend David Daley, author of a book whose name I can't say, but we'll call it Rat Flipped: The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. He's the former editor-in-chief at Salon. He's now a senior fellow at fairvote.org, where he continues the most important fight that we have in this country for fair elections for all, and specifically an end to partisan gerrymandering of our democracy. David Daley, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, Brad, it is great to be back. There is a lot going on this topic, isn't there?
Jeez. It's impossible to keep up, and sometimes it's dispiriting when you see how it's being delayed and delayed and delayed by the courts. I want to talk, of course, about your new piece out at Salon on those GOP documents that you unearthed. Is it my imagination, David, or does the dam really seem to have finally begun to burst on this issue of gerrymandering that you've been focusing on for so many years?
You know, I think that the courts have been consistently outraged by what the Republicans pulled off in 2010, 2011. Now you are beginning to see maps fall in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania. You saw districts fall in Virginia, in mm-hmm. Florida, in Texas. The problem is, here we are in 2018. Mm-hmm. We've been using these unconstitutional maps now this entire decade. There is no sense that we're going to have new maps in most of these states, with the possible exception of Pennsylvania, where it appears likely that we will, mm-hmm. in time for the 2018 election. We may well have the fourth of five elections this decade in all of these states held on unconstitutional maps. And we're staring down a redistricting year again in 2020 after the census. So we'll be going through all of this again in 2021. And Republicans have got huge structural advantages, thanks to partisan gerrymandering, in all of the key states, whether it's North Carolina, Ohio, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. So a lot depends on the rulings that are coming up at the court, and a lot depends on whether Democrats are able to get themselves organized in governor's races in 2018 to kind of earn a veto over mm-hmm. over maps that are even more flagrantly tilted the other way. So the technology that's going to draw these lines in 2021 is not going to be worse than the technology that was available in 2011.
No, it's going to be much better unless the court, the Supreme Court, rules that you can't draw lines like this in such a partisan way. But that decision doesn't come out till June, so we're sort of stuck with these maps, as you say, for the most part. Pennsylvania, however, that's another story, because that was a state ruling on the U.S. House maps. Will do you think we're going to get some fair maps there in Pennsylvania? And does it, the bigger picture, does it tell us that the best way to challenge these unlawful maps may now be through state courts instead of federal courts, since states seem less likely to stall the way the U.S. Supreme Court clearly has been doing on this matter?
It's interesting, right? I mean, it certainly opens up an entire new avenue for reformers who are looking for fair maps and small d democratic maps. In almost every case, state constitutions hold a more robust right to free and fair elections mm-hmm. than the U.S. Constitution does. The United States Supreme Court has never found a constitutional standard that bans partisan gerrymandering, the 240-year history of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the Pennsylvania state constitution has a clause saying that elections in the state must be, quote, free and equal. And folks were able to use that clause to challenge these maps to the state court and earn new maps. Now, whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court, this is what I do evidently, Brad, I lay out the potential for uh-huh. excitement and optimism, and then I squash it like
yes,
a bug.
Yes.
whether the U.S. Supreme Court will continue to let states do this, I think, remains to be seen. When Judge Alito turned down the request of Pennsylvania,
yeah,
Republicans to stay these maps, essentially the reason was because the U.S. Supreme Court is loath to get involved in interpretations of state constitutions, particularly of election issues. Mm-hmm. But I think we can all recall a time not that long ago, maybe say 18 years ago in yep. the state of Florida, a little case called Bush versus Gore, yep. in which they were more than happy to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
So when Justice Kennedy retires, if Justice Ginsburg or Justice Breyer steps down, we are probably only one or two justices away from there being five on that court who might be willing to intervene on this on the wrong side.
And this sort of brings me back to the question I had in the first place here was, if this was all done after the 2010 census, you mentioned, David, that, race-based gerrymandering has been found to be unconstitutional by the courts, but they have not found partisan gerrymandering, at least not yet, to be unlawful. And that's what we're dealing with here. Is that why none of these horribly drawn maps was actually blocked in advance before they could be used over now three and soon four elections? Shouldn't they have been blocked already under the Voting Rights Act before they were put in place for the first time and used in 2012?
Well, the amazing thing is that in all of these rulings on racial gerrymandering, the Supreme Court essentially said, you can't do that. But they said partisan gerrymandering is just fine. So what you had was all of these Republican mapmakers who took that as essentially open season to do as much partisan gerrymandering as they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually admit this. In North Carolina, in the middle of the Rucho case there that was challenging the constitutionality of the Republican drawn maps in that state, the state house, a chair who was in charge of the process there, admits it. He says, of course I was doing a partisan gerrymander. You said I couldn't do a racial gerrymander. I set out to draw a map that had 10 Republican congressmen and 3 Democrats because I didn't think that I could draw a map that had 11 Republicans and 2 Democrats. They actually come right out and admit this. So in many ways, the rulings on racial gerrymandering made it open season for them to do as much partisan gerrymandering as they wanted to. And because we're as polarized as we are, because our voting preferences are as predictable as they are, because the technology is so good to sort of have a sense of who lives where and what the impact is of drawing a line, a block in any direction, you can essentially use racial data. You can essentially use partisan data in a state like North Carolina as a proxy for racial data.
Mm. And that is what they did all over, it seems like, after 2010. Over at your old haunt, David Salon, you published an exclusive last week, including insider documents revealing the GOP's years-long scheme to gerrymander the nation in the plan that they called Red Map, which you write about in your book. And you detail, you summarize at Salon by saying that they proved more effective than any Republican had dared dreamed after those new maps were drawn up by the Republicans. They held the U.S. House in 2012, despite earning 1.4 million fewer votes than Democratic congressional candidates, and they won large GOP majorities in the Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and North Carolina state legislatures, even when more voters backed Democrats. That pattern has continued to repeat itself since 2012. Your piece at Salon is very long. It goes into a lot of details based on these new documents. I'm going to point folks towards it when I post the show tonight. I'll link over to it. But what do we learn in general from these newly uncovered documents that you did not know about beforehand?
It's really breathtaking. What this piece lays out is how early the Republicans began planning for Red Map, how detailed and meticulous their strategy was, exactly how they went about trying to raise the money for it, and how they instructed Republican state legislators to go about drawing maps. I've got their fundraising documents. Mm-hmm. I've got their PowerPoints from their very first presentations, both to legislators as well as to big dollar fundraisers. And they are very, very clear. It's almost frightening, the clarity of this. They intended to win these state legislative chambers with the express purpose of using that power to lock Democrats out of the room when new maps were drawn in 2011 after the census, and they were going to use that power in such a way as to lock in enduring congressional majorities for the next decade. They promised their donors that if they pony up the $30 million that it will take to fund Red Map, that they will wipe 25 swing congressional seats off the table, and as a result, they will save them about $250 million that they would have come asking for in order to fight in those seats otherwise. But by making them non-competitive, by locking them down in the red corner for the next decade,
mm-hmm.
They would save their donors money.
Yeah, and they were telling their donors exactly that. Meanwhile, they were telling the public that it's about the message that Republicans bring. It's not about the maps. But then they were going and talking to their donors and saying, yes, it was actually all about the maps. Now, nothing in that, however, was at the time seen to be unlawful, correct? Well, I mean, was this just smart, if brutally tough, politics? And if so, why didn't the Democrats do the same sort of micro-targeting at the same time?
It's perfectly legal. It's perfectly it's also perfectly brutal politics. What I would suggest, though, is that it is deeply damaging to the idea of representative democracy. Gerrymandering has been with us for a long, long time.
Yeah.
As long as there have been politicians, they have tried to draw districts to advantage themselves and to try to kneecap their opponents. There's nothing new about that. But because we've had gerrymandering for so long, because both sides have done it, we sometimes have a misunderstanding of what happened in 2010 and how fundamentally different it was from any other gerrymander in our country's history. The data and the technology now makes it so precise when you are drawing these lines that you can lock them in for a decade. If you go and if you look at Pennsylvania, Republicans drew the lines in Pennsylvania in 2001, and they had good advantages in Pennsylvania in the early part of that decade.
Mm-hmm.
But by 2006, when the public began to get frustrated with the Iraq War, in 2008, after the economy crashed, Democrats were able to defeat that gerrymander at the ballot box. They were able to turn Pennsylvania into a 12-7 Democratic state. In 2010, the Tea Party, the anti-Obama midterm, turns it the other way, and Pennsylvania goes 12 Republicans and 7 Democrats. After that election, all the lines get redrawn in the mm-hmm. state. In 2012, 52% of Pennsylvanian voters vote for Barack Obama, 51% of them vote for Democratic members of the U.S. House. Republicans, however, take 13 of the 18 seats that year, 71-point-something% of them. Democrats get 28% of the seats, even with more votes. So something changes in between 2008 and 2012. It's not that all of the Democrats in the state clustered or moved the big sort or the kind of mm-hmm. the sense that this is more about geography than gerrymandering. There's no evidence of that kind of a mass migration between 2008 and 2012. What there is all of the district lines changed, and they were drawn by mapmakers who knew precisely what they were doing. And it makes it impossible, or it makes it extraordinarily difficult
mm-hmm.
for Democrats to overcome that structural advantage at the ballot box.
Yeah, no, almost no.
Democrats have not taken a single seat back in any of those states. So I don't want to say it's impossible, but what I would say is that in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, in North Carolina, in Ohio, and Wisconsin, 5 competitive swing states, these districts are so strong that Democrats have not flipped a single one of those districts blue in this entire decade in 3 elections, and those states send 49 Republicans and 20 Democrats to Congress right now.
It's going to take a turnout like we have never seen in this country, it seems to me, to overcome this structural problem in 2018. At least in all of the other states that are not unredistricted. Last question. I've only got a minute here, David. Former Attorney General Eric Holder and Barack Obama have now teamed up to target elections in what seems to be the very same way, really, before the 2020 elections. They've been public about this. They want to be to get Democrats in there so the Democrats can redraw the map. Instead of Republicans after the 2020 census, is their scheme pretty much the same as the Republican red map scheme from 2010? Is this a new blue map effort, if you will?
I think you could call it that. That there's certainly more awareness on the Democratic side of how the process works, it seems, this time around. Democrats got caught flat-footed and napping in 2010. They didn't understand how the rules of the game had changed. So they seem at least ready to fight this time. The problem is that they fight from a massive disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
And what we just saw in Virginia, for example, where Democrats pick up 15 seats in the House of Delegates, they win the overall statewide vote there by 225,000 as far as the candidates for the lower house in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans keep control of the chamber 51-49.
Yep.
So there may be a blue wave, but there is also a red firewall that stands ready to knock it down. Democrats are probably going to need 2 seismic historic waves in order to have a shot at fair maps in 2021. And if they can't pull that off, and if the courts don't come in and do something in the meantime, the maps that are drawn in 2021 are the ones we're going to live with until 2031.
Yeah, that's the question. It's so much of this still remains, unfortunately, on the stolen U.S. Supreme Court and their decision in Gil v. Whitford that will come out in June. In the meantime, I think you came up with a great slogan for the Democrats, flat-footed and napping. Vote Democrat. David Daley, I'll point folks over to your new exclusive over at Salon, and of course urge them to buy your book, Rat Effed. That's all we can say.
Ask for it by name, folks.
Yes, ask for it by name. The story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy, which is not so secret anymore, thanks to the work of guys like David Daley. You can follow him on the Twitters at DaveDaley3. That's the number 3. And, of course, over at FairVote, which you can find on the web at fairvote.org. Thank you, David. I suspect we'll be talking to you very soon in this election year. Always great talking with you.
Always a pleasure on this end, too, Brett. Thank you. Anytime.
Thanks, boss. Yeah, he used to be my boss over at Salon when he was their editor-in-chief there, and I used to write there all the time.
Oh, that's adorable.
Yes, it is. And now we're still covering the same crap we were covering all of those years over at Salon. Him in a book, me on the radio. That's where we are. All right, a quick break, and we're going to come back with, we'll figure this out. I'm running late. We'll figure it out during the break. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast.
It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things.
Yeah. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen, you know why it's not easy being green?
Why?
Because the Green News Report gets pushed into the C block, and if I happen to go run on too late in the A and B block, then you're screwed.
That's
well,
you know,
News Report.
We're going to play the Green News Report, just not today.
All right. Tomorrow.
Yes.
I promise, I think. All right. That's it. So sorry about that. That said, I know you had some thoughts about Dave Daley and one other story I want to hit here.
Yeah, a couple of things that Dave Daley said. He said we needed two waves of huge voter turnout, both in 2018 and in 2020, because it requires getting state legislators in place to draw these maps after the 2020 census. And so otherwise, we're going to be stuck with whatever maps we get through 2031. The important thing here is the decade of 2020 to 2030 is our most crucial decade for getting the work done that we need to get done in order to have a chance at fighting climate change and making a real difference.
So when you say we, you're not talking about Democrats. You're talking about we as human beings.
We collectively,
civilization,
yes,
need
collectively
to do
as
this work.
As states. It's going to be our make or break decade. So seriously, get out and vote like their children's lives depend on it, because they do.
In 2018, and then again in
2020.
You're asking a lot of people. And as a matter of fact, you're asking a lot of Democrats who seem to be in no real rush to do anything about all of the problems that we have in our electoral system, where Republicans really have just about everything that can be gamed in their favor, illegally, unlawfully, or otherwise.
Got to fight like hell.
One more quick story before we get out. You know who else is not easy being? Republican Kevin Nicholson. He announced his bid to unseat incumbent Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin in 29 up in Minnesota. His own parents, just after he announced that, donated the legal maximum to Tammy Baldwin's campaign.
Oh.
Nicholson announced last July that he would seek the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate in Wisconsin. I meant Wisconsin. A federal election commission filing by Baldwin's campaign dated February 5 and available online shows that each of Nicholson's parents, Donna and Michael, both donated $2,700 to Baldwin in December 2017.
Why?
What do they know about him that
we
don't? FEC rules stipulate that those donations are the maximum that Nicholson's parents are allowed to donate to Baldwin during the primary election. Their own son is running for the U.S. Senate. They donated the max to his Democratic opponent.
Clearly, they do know something.
Apparently they can donate up to that amount, $2,700, during the general election again. So depending on if he becomes the nominee for the Republican Party, Tammy Baldwin may get another $2,700 from each of them. Nicholson has said on the campaign trail that he comes from a Democratic family. And as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported in November, his mother has donated thousands of dollars over the years to various Democratic organizations and candidates, including hundreds to Baldwin, though she's now given thousands to Baldwin, apparently. The contributions are the first that his parents have given to Baldwin since Nicholson announced his candidacy to try to oust the senator. In a statement to CNN, Nicholson said, quote, "My parents have a different worldview than I do, and it's not surprising that they would support a candidate like Tammy Baldwin who shares their perspective." Nicholson has previously faced questions about his political views. As a younger man, he was president of the College Democrats. And he spoke at the 2000 Democratic National Convention. He told Politico in a September story that his opinions permanently changed after his 2007 deployment to Iraq, when he became, quote, livid with Democrats' opposition to that war. He said, "I knew what we were doing there. We were stabilizing that country." And why did it need stabilization, Mr. Nicholson? Oh, yeah, because we broke it for fun, apparently. He said, "We made incredible amounts of progress in Iraq, and what I was hearing back home was a complete, absolute lie as politicians were running around calling it a failure." Oh, well, sorry about that, Mr. Nicholson. I guess it was a great success. Still is. The trillions we've spent trying to eradicate ISIS, who took the place of Al-Qaeda, who took the place of Saddam Hussein, that has been a tremendous success, hasn't it? Totally worth it. Totally worth the deaths of more than 4,000 Americans in the bargain out there as well. But anyway, good luck. Kevin Nicholson. I guess your parents are rooting against you, but we're all rooting for you. All right, that's it. We got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, David Daly of Fair Vote, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. Though, as ever, I thank you if you're able to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us continue to stay on your public airwaves throughout this 2018 election. We need your help. Bradblog.com/donate. That's it. On the Twitters and the Facebooks, I am simply The Brad Blog. And via email, you can find me at bradcast@bradblog.com. That's it. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.